reading sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Pin Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, it is cool. We are back on the Andy Pin Show. And today is the 19th of May. As I mentioned before, it's Pete Townsend's birthday. So on the 15-minute breaks, we're listening to a little bit of solo Pete Townsend music. It's also the birthday of Jim Lehrer, who was born in 1934, Malcolm X, who was born in 1925, and Johns Hopkins, 1795. Of course, he's dead now. And on this day, the first American criminal conviction based on fingerprint evidence occurred. It occurred in New York City, and folks, guess the year. Now think about this. How early would law enforcement have been using fingerprints? What year would that be? Would it be before 1950? Would it be before 1940? 1930? 1920? 1900? Would it be before 1890? Think about it. Are you ready? Yes, you were right. 1911 was when we started using fingerprints for criminal convictions. Anyway, let's go back to a couple of lighter items. The Washington Post did a really interesting article this morning. They don't usually cover this stuff, but they put a bottom of the front page and into the back page a long article about the spat, the fight between Keith Olbermann and Bill O'Reilly. Now, if you watch cable network news, you might know about this because Bill O'Reilly and Keith Olbermann are on across from each other, and one's a liberal and one's a conservative. O'Reilly has the O'Reilly Factor, the number one rated show on cable television, and he covers a variety of things from he started the war on Christmas, essentially, or the notion there was a war on Christmas. He had a boycott of France because France wouldn't give us a green light to go into Iraq, a few things like that. And Keith Olbermann has emerged on MSNBC as the leading voice over there of liberal opinion. Now, Olbermann has a habit of mocking Bill O'Reilly. And so he has a series called the world's worst or something, and he covers the worser and the worst, and he awards it to three people that, you know, screwed up or did something he doesn't think was right. O'Reilly has something similar. He calls it pinheads and patriots, but he doesn't necessarily pick on Olbermann. Olbermann picks on O'Reilly a lot. So somebody's in the news that does something stupid, like a guy you know, shoots himself in the foot or something, he gets worst of the day. But in general, it's famous people. So Rush Limbaugh wins once a week. Karl Rove might win once a month, whatever. But Bill O'Reilly wins three times a week. He either gets second or third place, probably three times a week. He's won this award dozens of times. So it's Olbermann just mocking Bill O'Reilly. Well, it's escalated, and what happened was the powers that be that run the two networks, and NBC runs MSNBC, and Fox News and Rupert Murdoch own Fox News and Bill O'Reilly's show. And so they have talked at the highest levels and said, hey, we got to rein in these attack dogs. It's hurting both of us. They couldn't reach an agreement because neither of them could agree on who was at fault and who was stepping over the line and where the line was. So it continues. And so you can tune in at 8 p.m. and flip back and forth on these two channels, and you hear two very different views of the world. But it escalated, and this I don't need to bore you anymore with this, but the whole Washington Post article was about what's going on up the ladder, both at the president of these two networks and then at the ownership above that, right, like Rupert Murdoch's level. And, of course, Roger Ailes is the chairman of Fox News, and Roger Ailes, of course, was a Republican, more than a Republican operative. In here somewhere in this article, they referred to Ailes as like a former Republican operative, as though he wasn't even lighter than that it was, as though he didn't have a formative role. I mean, it would be the equivalent of NBC putting the Ragin' Cajun in charge of the NBC network, the news department, right? That's just not how the major networks operate. You can say they're liberal if you want, but they haven't gone and put James Carville in charge of the news programs, whereas that's what Rupert Murdoch did with Roger Ailes. Anyway, that fight continues. You can check it out any night of the week. Little esoteric news here. A gentleman by the name of Hans von Spakovsky withdrew his name from consideration to be on the Federal Election Commission. So I'll try and keep this short to keep from boring you. But von Spakovsky is a former Justice Department lawyer who Bush nominated to serve a term on the Federal Elections Commission. The Federal Election Commission is unique in that it has, I think, three Republicans and three Democrats, and they're supposed to pass rules and decisions about whether or not people are doing fair campaigning, whether they're breaking campaign laws, and whether they should be fined. That all takes place after the fact, of course. They can never move quickly and stop wrongdoing, but they can fine it or expose it afterwards. Well, there have been so much attrition and people dropping off of that commission, and this stalemate over von Spakovsky that they only had two members on the commission. They didn't even have a majority so that they could make rulings. And the Democrats refused to confirm Spakovsky because he basically was in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and it's been alleged, and there's some pretty good evidence, that he used political considerations to make decisions. And so the Democrats are saying, under no circumstances are we going to allow this guy to represent Republicans on the Federal Election Commission. Well, the Republicans and Bush have said, look, we are not going to have you vote on these folks one at a time, yes or no on each person, and we'll see who gets confirmed. You must consider them as a package. There are two more Republicans, two more Democrats to go on this committee. You either vote them all up or down, but you can't single out von Spakovsky. Well, that's the stalemate, and it's been in place for a couple of years, which is why there's only two members left on that committee. Now, of course, with him gone, there's a chance for a breakthrough. But basically, the Federal Election Commission, not that it's all that powerful or controls all that much when they are working together well, but with only two members, they can't do a dang thing this election cycle. And, of course, we know we're going to see some dirty politics coming up. We're going to see violations of campaign finance law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Interesting couple of articles that came out over the weekend. Actually, the beginning of the weekend, the end of last week. One is that a September 11th conspirator, the alleged 20th hijacker, who we've kept in Guantanamo Bay since, read it, 2002, we've kept him for almost 6 years now, incommunicado for the most part, and the Bush administration has wanted to, quote, bring him to justice, wanted to try him, and what's happened so far is they've run into a dead end. So there have been very few, if any, I think there may have been one successful trial and conviction of someone that was in Guantanamo Bay. Well, this guy just got off, right? Capital charges were dismissed against the 20th hijacker by the legal officer who's supervising the military trials at Guantanamo Bay. And basically, while this is a very serious setback for the administration's attempt to try and convict these guys, it reminds us of why it's being done. So what the judge said is, look, you've had him, this guy's incoherent in court. He's a broken man. He can't even communicate meaningfully with his lawyers and people that are trying to help him. He is a basket case, apparently. That's what I'm inferring from this. And his statements were unreliable and inadmissible. They were either coerced or the reason that this is being shut off is that when he gets on the stand, he would describe the torture that he underwent. But the point is, basically, the Bush administration handed down permission to torture these guys, both Abu Ghraib kinds of torture, that is sexual humiliation torture and intimidation with dogs, and real serious torture like extremes of temperature, squat, making them squat or stand for hours at a time, a variety of things like that, hot and cold, exposure to hot and cold temperatures, you know, you remove all their clothes and you make their cell freezing, that kind of thing. Try it sometime. It's rather irritating. Because of all the things we did to the 20th hijacker, we're probably not going to be able to convict him of a crime and put him away for life or even give him the death sentence. And we have George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld to thank for that. That's basically blowback from our torture policy. Of course, the president says we don't torture because he believes that if the president says it's not torture, then it's not torture. Let me move on to one last subject, then we're going to take a break, and then move on to the election coverage. Actually, we're going to move on to Bush's speech in Israel and his whole trip to the Middle East. So a doctor that works for the Veterans Affairs Center, I guess it's called, has sent a memo out a while back, and it just came out, that he's in charge of post-traumatic stress disorder programs at a particular medical facility for veterans that's in Texas. And he basically told the staff in a memo to stop diagnosing PTSD so readily because too many veterans were getting government disability payments for their condition. Basically said it's a complex thing to diagnose. Let us not rush into anything. Because as soon as you give these people this diagnosis, they're entitled to all this aid, like couple thousand dollars a month, indefinitely. Well, the memo came out, and the Veterans Affairs Department had to distance itself from it and said that's not our policy, because it's just one more example of where the Bush administration says we support the troops and the Democrats don't, but bottom line is, when it comes to actually helping out the troops, they're trying to save a little money here and there. And I'm not sure exactly whether we're diagnosing too much PTSD, but we always say nothing's too good for our soldiers, and yet, apparently, something is too good for our soldiers. Let's listen to a little bit of Pete Townsend on his birthday, and we'll be right back.
20% of the people on the far right and 20% on the far left that are ruining this country for the rest of us. We deserve better.
The Andy Finch Show. Something special in the airwaves.
We deserve better. We deserve better.
Not only do you deserve better, you are getting better right here on The Andy Finch Show on WEBR Radio in Fairfax County, Virginia. So, let's talk a little bit about the president's latest trip overseas. You know, it's not at all uncommon for a president to go overseas when he's a lame duck, that is, the last year or so in office, because you get a lot of respect overseas, theoretically. If you're well-liked, you do very well over there. People applaud you, and you seem relevant in a way you might not at home. I mean, Clinton went overseas the last couple of years. Reagan went overseas, so it's a pretty common thing. Bush went to help Israel celebrate its 60th birthday. And a couple of things happened. One is that not too much was accomplished on the trip. So he had two main goals, I would say, besides the celebratory goal. And really, it was about going and helping Israel celebrate its 60th anniversary. They didn't really expect breakthroughs. But there are two main goals. One is a Arab-Israeli peace deal, settled the Palestinian-Israeli question, and the president continues to say that he thinks it's possible to have a solution by the end of the year, in other words, by the time he leaves office. He's been saying that now for about a year. Well, I hate to be a pessimist because I'm an eternal optimist about everything in the world, but I'm also a realist when the handwriting's on the wall, and there is no chance that we're going to see an agreement before George W. Bush leaves office. And there's two or three primary reasons for this. The first is that Bush ignored this issue for 6 years. Now, he claims and others claim, well, Arafat was a stumbling block to peace, so we couldn't negotiate with him, so we waited till he died, and we finally got people we can deal with. Maybe. But these things take so much time and so much preparation, and there's been no sign that the Bush administration has been very serious about it until quite recently. You just don't get the Middle East to turn on a dime. You don't get a solution generated in a short period of time. And, of course, we're not working here on the Israelis' timetable or the Palestinians' timetable or the Arabs' timetable. We're working on George W. Bush's timetable. He's leaving office, so we must have a deal before then. Lame ducks are treated with little or no respect in these kinds of situations. Why would anyone make concessions and trust George Bush to deliver on his promises since he's leaving office and the next president's going to change the strategy? Probably. That's the first thing. Second thing is the leaders over there are weakened. Ehud Olmert, the prime minister of Israel, is severely weakened. He's not trusted by the average Israeli to strike a peace deal. You know, Ariel Sharon, who's still in a coma and will never probably end up being have any kind of anything to do with Israeli politics again, he had the credibility with people. If he had said, yes, it's worth taking a chance to sign up for this deal, he had the credibility to get people to do it. It's not clear he would have, but he could have. But Olmert does not. He's been beset by scandal. He oversaw the invasion of Lebanon that backfired wildly, and it's the first war that Israel didn't win outright. Just a mess that they've got over there. So we'll see what happens, but I don't think anything can come of this because Olmert's weakened. And also, Abbas, the Palestinian president, is weakened. He only has control of part of his territory. The Gaza Strip was taken over by Hamas last year, and they're still firing Katyusha rockets into Israel and wounding and killing people occasionally. And so it's just a mess, and it ain't going to get solved by the time George W. Bush leaves office. So, but that was one reason he went there, was to see if he could forward the peace process. And, of course, Secretary Gates and Condi Rice, Defense and State Departments, are both working this issue as well. The other reason he went over was to talk to the Saudis about upping oil prices. Now, I mean, sorry, upping oil production, which would reduce oil prices. Now, you have to go back and remember what George W. Bush promised when he was a candidate. Of course, it's easy to promise stuff when you're a candidate, but basically, Bush claimed when he was a candidate that what you need to do is you need to jawbone the Saudis and the other Arab oil-producing countries. Basically, he complained about the Clinton administration and said, hey, you have got to do something about this. We can't have oil prices where they are. At the time when Bush was running for president back in the 2000 campaign, oil was $28 a barrel. Last week, oil was $127 a barrel. So it's gone up $100 a barrel, or nearly 400% in 8 years. And what Bush said at the time, he was criticizing Bill Clinton and his administration for the high gas prices. And he said, hey, look, the president must jawbone oil-producing nations and persuade them to drop their rates or increase production. And he promised that he would bring down gas prices by creating, quote, political goodwill with oil-producing nations and saying, we'll work with our friends in OPEC and convince them to open up the spigot. Well, we can see how well that worked. He talked to Saudi Arabia, and they said, you know, seems to us the fundamentals are in the oil market are sound, that the price is where it ought to be, the production's where it ought to be. And they rebuffed him. They didn't give him what he wants. So we are dealing with the jawboning of an ass, I suppose you might say, just to get biblical for a moment. So there's that piece of his trip. Now, the last thing worth discussing is the controversy surrounding Bush's speech to the Israeli Knesset. So he went over there to help Israel celebrate their 20th anniversary, and he went on the attack. Okay? And what he said was, let's see, I better find the direct comments. Here they are. What he said was he basically raised the specter of Hitler and the appeasement that Neville Chamberlain did, although he didn't mention Chamberlain by name. He used the word appeasement and said basically, he was basically saying, if you talk to Iran, you're appeasing them, which of course logically doesn't make a lot of sense. Talking is not appeasing. Appeasing is appeasing. But here's the quote that everyone infers, both Republican and Democrats, infers that he was referring to Barack Obama, who has said that he would be willing to sit down with Iran and talk. Here's Bush's quote. And keep in mind, you often hear Republicans complain about Democrats, like when Nancy Pelosi went to Syria. They said she went to foreign soil and spoke out about her country. When Bill Clinton was accused of participating in an anti-war protest in England unfairly, this went back to his college or his grad school days, right? They said, imagine, he went on foreign soil and besmirched the good name of the U.S. Well, here's George W. Bush, the current president, jumping into the political fray, into the election, with the following comment. Quote, some seem to believe that we should negotiate with the terrorists and radicals as if some ingenious argument will persuade them that they have been wrong all along. This is in front of the Israeli Knesset. Quote, we have heard this foolish delusion before. As Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, Lord, if I'd only could have talked with Hitler, all of this might have been avoided. We have an obligation to call this what it is, the false comfort of appeasement, which has been repeatedly discredited by history. Well, the response was pretty quick. Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, a whole raft of Democrats came out and condemned Bush's remarks because the argument is that as a U.S. senator, you don't go overseas and criticize the president from foreign soil. You want to criticize the president, do it at home. You don't do it in front of the rest of the world. But if it applies that direction, why shouldn't it apply to the president? He is, after all, representing the entire country. Why would he attack Barack Obama or one party, essentially? So Bush has taken a lot of heat for this. Of course, conservatives don't mind. They're saying, well, it's true. But in fact, it's a breach of protocol. Beyond which, it's not true. It's a very poor analogy, and here's why. He started with, some seem to believe we should negotiate with the terrorists and radicals as if some ingenious argument will persuade them they have been wrong all along. No, you don't negotiate to persuade them that you are right and they are wrong. We're on opposite sides of this issue. You're never going to persuade, in the case of the Soviet Union, we were never going to persuade them that we were right and they were wrong. The question is, can you reach an agreement that will allow peaceful coexistence? And that seemed to be the thing that Bush didn't get, and I don't know why. And I do, but I'm not going to tell you right now. When we come back, though, I might tell you if you're good.